I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Got a headache.
Me too.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it COVID?
I don't know. Maybe. You know? I mean, the second if I thought I had it, all of a sudden I wouldn't be able to breathe.
Mm.
I'd have body aches. You know how the mind works. It's crazy how that works. I had a real interesting A and B with that. I'm not going to get into the specifics because it's my own body and my own life. Fuck you. I'm not telling. But I had a situation like a year ago where there was something I was really concerned about on my body. And while I was getting it checked out, it really hurt, you know? It was like I was constantly fixated on it and I was like having some pain. And then I get it checked out and the second, literally like minutes after I found out exactly what it is and it wasn't going to kill me, I look down and I'm like, wait, it doesn't hurt anymore. That's weird. You know? It was this pretty obvious A and B where I'm like, maybe there was pain, but I was definitely making it way worse.
Yeah, I've had that, man. The mind is powerful.
It is?
That's why you should never, ever use the internet to diagnose your illnesses.
Oh, that's a fact. Well, I mean,
cancer. It's all cancer. Or
yeah, within four clicks, you have cancer. Yeah. Yeah. It's too easy. I mean, it's like, yeah, all those nondescript symptoms. It's like stomach pain. Yeah, cancer. It's possible. It's possible if you have stomach pain, you have cancer. You know, the robot doesn't know that. How's it going, Brad?
It's okay. It's good. Just chilling, you know. Spent some time out on the playground, freezing my butt off.
Yeah, you told me you were selling weed to kids today?
Yeah, made some money from the eighth graders.
Yeah, they're like, yo, is old man New England here with the grass?
Yo, screw those kids. They don't know what they're getting. I'm selling them fucking oregano.
When I was a kid, I went to buy weed once, and the guy tried to sell us green crayon shavings. We were old enough to look at it and be like, you fucking serious, dude? Damn. You know, like I'd seen I've seen people go into their parents' cupboards and take herbs and spices and put it in a bag and pretend it's weed.
Right.
And if you don't know any better, you know, it's like, okay, it's green, it's dry, it looks like something. But I mean, I looked at this kid, we're like, dude, it's not even forest green. This is like lime green. I'm like, come on, fella. You know? I wonder what happened to a kid like that.
What do you think is wrong with us? That's
probably an insurance salesman or something now.
He's probably a successful salesman of something. That's the thing.
I know. It's crazy how that works. I was covering something on the tune-up yesterday. We do a segment called This Day in Music History. And yesterday was like an anniversary of Frank Sinatra Jr. being kidnapped.
Oh, shit.
I don't know if you know this, but in 1963,
something.
Yeah, he was like eating chicken in his underwear in like a hotel in Lake Tahoe, and these people came and swept him up, and he basically was blindfolded and in a trunk for 2 days, and Frank Sinatra had to pay $240,000 to get him,
which is like, it's questionable whether old Frank had some ties to people that, you know, you might not want to get on the wrong side of, but maybe that was them.
Yes. Wait, what were we talking about just before that? Because this was getting to a point.
We were talking about psychosomatic diagnoses and selling weed to...
So this guy who kidnapped Frank Sinatra's kid, when, you know, he ended up, of course, got caught like 2 days after and went to trial. But his reasoning was that he was helping two families at once. He's like, I'm getting money for my family, but I'm also helping the estranged Sinatra family, you know, get back together and really retie their family roots by kidnapping the kid.
Right.
But the thing that really stood out to me is the guy only got 4.5 years in prison and got out and became a millionaire.
What?
In real estate, and owned like houses in Texas and Mississippi and an apartment in LA, and ended up being this like massively successful rich person. So all this was getting to the point that the guy who sells lime green crayon shavings,
is
probably rich and doing really well. Yeah, that's just the way the world shakes out.
There's a sucker born every minute.
I know. I'm usually him, you know.
I definitely recall being a young and naive kid who's like, maybe it is a kind of weed that we don't know about. You know, like, I think I'm sure that I definitely, I don't know if I ever bought anything that wasn't weed, but I definitely smoked some shit, like rolled up leaves that the fucking older kids were like, here, dude, this is a new kind of pot.
It's called Arkansas Magic, man. It just smells like parsley. I'm telling you.
I mean, that literally happened to me. I smoked like half of a fucking like maple leaf or some shit, like rolled up.
Yeah, it's amazing what you think. I had a friend of mine. We walked to our, I think, like a 7th or 8th grade school dance. And he had convinced himself that you could get high by smoking incense. So we had these little like incense cones that were like trying to smoke before the dance.
It's like poison.
I know. I don't even know what it is. And then like a principal came up and we're like, oh God. And I ended up like putting in my pocket and patting it. And then, so not only went to this school dance smelling like incense, not stoned, with a huge hole in my pocket from where I burnt through. Not the finest look. Not the finest
look. You probably could get wicked high from smoking fucking incense because it's like pure poison.
Different kind of high. I could also like, I could smoke my couch. I'd probably feel something, you know? Still might not be the best idea. I bet Chris has smoked, Chris Shiflett has probably smoked something weird along the years, you know?
He's had his moments for sure.
Yeah, something out of a tin can somewhere. You don't go on those squat tours in Europe and being no use for a name as long as he was without getting into the dirty business, you know?
Thanks to Max Huber, who has been on the show, he gave us the mystery friend, but, he gave me this other one that I didn't ask about. You just reminded me of it, which was he's like, you're asking about A, the thing that we ended up asking about, or B, trying to score meth on Polk Street and ending up with crack.
Yeah.
He's like, I don't know if Chris is going to want to talk about that. And Prague sounds more interesting anyway.
I don't want to answer that to your kids these days. That's funny, man. But it was great Chris came on. What a great conversation. I really enjoyed talking to him. Lively spirit, a lively guy, you know, he just has like a bubbling kind of personality. I wanted to talk to him longer.
Yeah, Chris is on the ball. He's got stuff to talk about. And
I got a funny story, though, Brad, that I saved for the intro.
Okay, let's hear it.
Are we too far into the intro?
Funnier
Should I save
than,
it for the outro?
Than smoking your...
smoking some incense.
Smoking crayons and incense.
So, you know, uniquely, Gaslight got to open for Foo Fighters a couple times. You know, we played like some festivals with them and then had a couple shows. There was one in Italy. It was like this crazy show on a giant like compound. You know how it is, like, you know, band like that just brings like they bring the show. Right. You know what I mean? Like, you don't need a place with everything. They got everything. Yeah. They got this huge production. And and then I think, you know, a day or two after, we played a show in Madrid in Spain, and it was like an arena show. So obviously this is just a unique experience anyway. I'm at an arena in Madrid, Spain. It was my wife's birthday was around then. This is like June or July 2011, somewhere around then. Okay. And we were feeling pretty sprightly, even just like being there, you know, that's something like, and we never really got used to shit like that. Like, right. You know, you're in a backstage at an arena in Spain opening for one of these bands. And it's just like, Jesus Christ, like
it's baller, dude,
what happened? Like, this is wild, you know? So it was kind of like a party night. We randomly had our friend Andy Diamond, who's a sort of notorious New Brunswick guy, show promoter, great guy. And we used to bring him on tour. He didn't do anything. he would just come. He had no touring skills. He couldn't change his string or drive or, you know, he just came and made people feel good. And he was feeling frisky. And I think he had some beverages. And even before the show, we kind of hatched a plan to do something funny. We're like, we're the punk rock band at the arena show. What's going to happen? So the decision was to put Andy Diamond drunk in a gorilla suit to intro Gaslight Anthem at this show.
Okay.
So like, we're the first band. Not many people know who we are anyway. And you know, the arena is opening up and we're about to play. And we sent like a little of 5'4" Italian guy from East Brunswick, New Jersey, in a gorilla suit up onto the stage to just speak random letters of English that made no sense and kind of hop around and scream the Gaslight Anthem. It was fucking hilarious. So the show is fine. Like, I don't know. There's nothing too descript about the show. The thing that really stood out in my mind was, you know, after the show, I let myself let loose a little, had some drinks, and I'm hanging out. And me and my, you know, then girlfriend, now wife, like, go out into the crowd. And, you know, it just had been a long time since I'd been in like an arena show environment. I mean, it might have even been since I saw like Rush when I was a kid or like something. And automatically, I got really like lured into the experience. And after just a few minutes, I'm like looking around the crowd and I'm watching the Foo Fighters. I'm like, wow, this is like, it's an electric fucking show. This is like magical. There's like something going on here. And the one thing that really stood out to me is like the Foo Fighters and maybe Grohl specifically, there was not like a person in that arena who didn't think Dave Grohl wasn't talking to them.
Right.
You know, I'm like walking around this whole place, you know, hundreds of feet from the stage, and these people in like the back row of the upper section, like this guy just had in their fucking hands, man. Like he is that kind of like, he's that kind of performer and they're that kind of band where like it somehow felt like a club show, you know? It was like this really just loud, intimate, sweaty experience. And then, you know, you do some research on Foo Fighters and that's just like what they do. You know, they are just a fucking powerhouse rock band. Right. Like, and they seem to do this everywhere they go in like every arena they play. And it's really spectacular to see, you know? And then you start to break it down. You'd be like, oh, that guy was in Scream. That guy was in Sunny Day Real Estate. That guy was in No Use for a Name. Like, that shit's cool. Right. You know, and you're seeing that too. Like, people who kind of came from the same world we did. And then the funniest part about this story is we go outside after the show. I think we were loaded out. We were waiting for, like, merch to count out or something. So we had a couple hours. And we're sort of by the back where, like, you know, there's maybe 50, 100 like massive Foo Fighters fans like waiting back there. And, you know, we walk out to very little fanfare, you know, obviously they're Foo Fighters fans. And, you know, we're feeling pretty loose. And an American kid walks up to me and he's like, hey, what's up, man? I'm like, hey, American, what's going on? You know, we start chatting. Where are you from? Where are you from? He's like, yeah. So what, you know, what are you doing? Like, you know, how do you play music in a place like this? And he starts asking me these questions. I'm like, yeah, this. He's like, yeah, how do you guys do this and this? And I'm like starting to put it together. And I'm like, oh, I'm like, wait, this is a strange line of questioning. And then he asked me one more question. And I figured it out. And I had to like ask the kid. I'm like, bro, I don't want to be a dick. I'm like, you know, I'm not Dave Grohl, right? And the kid's just like, yeah. Like, yeah, of course. Like, yeah. Like, so what else are you doing tonight, man? Dude, the whole time I was sitting there, like in the middle of the conversation, being like, this kid's weird. This is a strange line of questioning he's asking me. And yeah, it turned out he thought I was Dave Grohl the entire time. Pretty funny, huh?
That is,
I guess,
funny.
I was a little slimmer in those days. I think I'm much taller than Dave Grohl, which made me think this guy wasn't the biggest fan. You know, right. It's like, you know how, I don't know if you experience this at all, but like, if you're like the one American kid in like Dusseldorf, Germany, and like the American band comes there,
yeah,
like it's like, oh, we're American, and like I love everything, you know, I love Nickelback, so I love you guys. Like, there's no what kind of music you're into anymore. It's just like these people in a different place. So I think he was a novice Foo Fighters fan who was, you know, playing off to be a bigger one, and actually thought my fucking dirty ass is Dave Grohl after the show. I was even amazed. I'm like, how do you think he got out here so fast? Like, how did he shower and get out here so quick? And why does he have no security? I'm like, you know, you should put this together, fella.
Newbie, yeah, to the whole scene.
Newbie, but pretty funny. And then it definitely became a joke for a long time, where people just like randomly walk up to me and be like, "Yeah, you're not Dave Grohl, right?" Like all my friends and my wife and shit. Yeah. I mean, I kind of look like him, I guess. Was it just the long hair and a mustache?
Yeah, there's some, yeah, you know, if you don't know him, or if look for the guy with the long hair and the mustache.
Yeah. Pretty funny though, huh?
It is a funny story. I'm glad you told it.
Yeah. This is a long intro. Sorry to anyone who tuned in just to hear Chris and just heard me and Brad for 15 minutes. You know what? It's my podcast. Go fuck yourselves. but please enjoy this interview with Chris. It's delicious. It's going off
track. It totally splits them up. And not only that, but like, we're recording the wave files too, so they're not MP3s.
Oh, wow.
I would recommend
Brad, it. I feel like you could get a professorship now.
In podcasting?
Like, yeah, you could probably get like some guest professorship.
Hey, dude, if Jonah is teaching podcast,
I know. This is like, it's a thing now. I don't know if you know that. A lot of people have podcasts.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, a couple.
Chris, tell you, Professor Worrell sounds awfully like Hogwarts-esque.
Dude, my dad was a professor. A Professor Worrell. Yeah, my dad was a professor.
Nice.
Do you know, Chris, do you know that his dad is a biblical archaeologist?
No, but yeah, I know who I'm going to next time I want to argue about religion.
Not me, dude.
I'm going you're going to be my one phone call for backup.
We'll call my dad. We can call my dad.
All right, there you go.
Because it didn't take.
I heard that the other day, that someone, it was on a sports thing, and that famous celebrity chef Dave Chang won $1 million on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, you know, raising money for food service and stuff like that. It was a good cause. But he had to use a sports writer named Mina Kimes for his phone a friend. And I couldn't help but think, I'm like, wait, who do I call? Who would be like the person I know who just has well-versed knowledge in everything, basically? Oof. Who would yours be, Chris? Who would you go? Who's your go-to phone a friend if you were on the program?
That's a really good question. I don't think I know any. I know lots of people that I could go to if it was like, who mixed Highway to Hell?
Right, you know, exactly.
Like,
yeah.
Something like that. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's like, I got a deep, deep roster for those questions. Yeah, yeah. But for like everything else in the world, I'm a little light. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think any of us hang out with enough of those types. Even this son of a professor.
That's right. I'm a son of a professor too. Did you know that?
I didn't know that. What's the what's professor of what?
My dad was a sociology professor for a time.
Interesting.
And then he wasn't for quite a while as well.
Do you think that has anything to do with your, you know, general interest in people, you know, like, and the way, you know, you seem like kind of an observer. It's pretty obvious with the podcast. You're curious about people. Is that from your dad?
I don't think so. Cause it's funny. I don't think my dad had that, you know, I don't think was really part of his person. I mean, maybe it was, and I just didn't see it. You know, I don't know. It's an interesting thing. My dad passed away quite a while ago now, and he was in his early 60s. So it was like right after I joined Foo Fighters, my dad passed away, which is
gotcha.
It's a bummer because he died just a little before I was like really asking the big questions of life or wanting to pick his brain about, well, what'd you do when you were 18? You know, so like a lot of that stuff just kind of died with my dad. So I don't really know like why he went into sociology when he did, you know, I don't know. Yeah. So it's a bit of a mystery.
We'll call it a preternatural understanding.
there you go. I think my curiosity, you know, as far as like my own podcast goes, has always been like when it just became kind of clear to me pretty early in doing it, that it was like the only way that I was ever going to wind up just having like a lengthy conversation about a bunch of bullshit with like Dwight Yoakam and Lucinda Williams and people like that. You know what I mean?
Because
like, you know, it is in rock and roll, you meet a lot of like your heroes, but you don't necessarily have a deep conversation with them.
Sure.
It's like, it's at a gig and it's all crazy backstage and you're starstruck and you know, that thing.
Right.
So that's probably as much a driving force of it for me as anything. I mean, it's funny. I just interviewed Tommy Lee a couple days ago, you know,
oh, wow.
from the crew. And I just turned into like, I was like 11 years old. Like just
sure.
like, I just had my like list of everything I always wondered when I was like staring at the back cover of Shout at the Devil or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Cause you must have been, I mean, I read somewhere along the line of doing this research that one of your favorite groups ever is Hanoi Rocks.
Indeed.
So indeed. I'm sure. I mean, for someone who's a Hanoi Rocks, like a naturalist, what wasn't Motley Crue like the second gen, like second generation, like
no,
it was Motley Crue early enough?
Well, Motley Crue was a little ahead of, well, as far as like being a kid in America, I knew Motley Crue years before I knew Hanoi Rocks. I discovered Hanoi Rocks like when they were kind of like the last album that they made was like kind of starting to break through in America. And we would like, there was like a one record store in Goleta that we would take the bus out to, and they might have a copy of the latest Kerrang.
Okay.
You know? So it didn't seem like it came like regularly. It was just every now and again. So you started seeing their picture pop up in Kerrang and stuff like that. And then MTV started showing a couple of their videos here and there. And so really like I discovered Hanoi Rocks right as they like fell apart, because then that car crash happened.
Right.
But you know, it's interesting, like that whole scene and what it, and all the bands that sort of came out of it. Like, you know, I grew up a little bit north of Los Angeles and so that kind of changed rock and roll, changed the rock and roll scene from like kind of like American metal to like kind of like LA glam rock, you know?
Yeah, and, right.
But none of those bands really took from Hanoi's sound.
Well, that's
the
thing for
Hanoi's look, you know?
For people that don't realize, like they were the one band that kind of like actually rocked. I mean, like they had a little more punk to their vibe than just like glam, right?
Well, I always thought of it. I mean, if you think of like the OG glam rock stuff, if you think of like New York Dolls and obviously like Ziggy and T-Rex, and you could even throw like the original Alice Cooper band maybe could get thrown in there you know, maybe like Slade and Mott the Hoople or whatever, you know, like those bands weren't heavy metal bands. I mean, that's a pretty wide range of sound. And a lot of them were way more just kind of rock and roll, you know? I think a New York Dolls is just like a straight up rock and roll band.
Right.
And not heavy metal at all. And so to me, you know, the stuff that happened in LA sort of post Hanoi Rocks, like was way more influenced by like Aerosmith and stuff like that.
Right.
Mm. And whereas to my ear, Hanoi Rocks had a much more like, almost like just, I get, because they were European, it just sounded more European, you know, it was more like major key, minor key, not so bluesy, you know?
Right.
Almost like, you know, if the Damned were a little more colorful or something, you know,
I kind of thought
of them that way. I don't know. It was just different, but,
And what year about was that switching in LA?
I think Two Steps from the Move came out in 84, and it was like right after that I started seeing flyers and ads in BAM magazine for bands like, you know, Guns N' Roses and Poison and, Jet Boy and Faster Pussycat and all that stuff came along, and LA Guns, and you know, there was all those bands around. And so, you know, I think that scene was, that was an interesting scene. I mean, cause I'd started going to gigs when I was in junior high and started going to see, you know, I was going to see heavy metal bands, you know, if they came through Santa Barbara, we'd go down to LA and go see bands and stuff. And then when that shift happened in kind of like, I want to say like 85 ish, right around there. I'm fucking senile, man. I get the dates wrong all the time.
Long. Take it easy on yourself. You know, I mean, I know for people of, you know, our age and above, like we talk about 1985, like, oh, this is a long fucking time ago now, you know?
It really was.
No, it wasn't that really long was. Ago. No, it wasn't that long ago. Benny, it was just, I still remember. Yeah, some of it.
it's really funny, you know. I mean, I've talked about this before. It's ridiculous how much I revisit the early '80s, sort of before that, more than almost anything else. Like if I'm going for a run, you know, that's like almost the only time I listen to music now is if I'm like exercising. Or maybe if I'm in the car, but if I'm like exercising, I have to listen to something kind of up. And so I always listen to like, you know, I just sort of scroll through the you know, like Stand Up and Shout by Dio, or, you know, it's like always something like that. You know, I need something like that to get my heart racing.
But what age were you when that stuff was coming out? I feel like there's always this comfort zone that people find in music, and it's probably like that few year window when it just like became yours, you know, like whatever that music was, it doesn't matter. It became yours. There's some awful, awful hardcore stuff that I go back to and I'm like, oh, let me give this a test run. It's been about 20 years since I listened to this 7-inch. And I'm like, fuck, that's not good. You know, like,
well, you know, what's funny is like a lot of like the punk rock stuff that I was into in like the late 80s and through the, you know, well into the 90s. I trip out on that now when I listen to it, like how shitty those records sound.
Oh, yes.
I mean, it's stuff that I like, but it sounds like considerably worse than the stuff that was maybe recorded even a few years earlier. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah, there so was much a terrible, so, yeah, there was a thin. Terrible transition into the 80s when like, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that somebody has studied this and found a reason for it, but it was almost like they were trying too hard.
Professor.
that's what I'll be a professor of. Professor of early 80s recording techniques.
I truly think it was like the process of people beginning to be able to record more economically.
It wasn't, you know, economical in the 80s still. I mean, there was like 8 tracks that were economical, but it wasn't. You still had to go into a real studio.
Right, exactly. Right, like even when I started recording music in like the early 90s, you know, recording studios and recording, it was kind of unreachable and it was hard. You know what I mean? You needed money, you needed time, you needed like, and that's why, you know, putting a demo out at that time was like having an album, because you actually like managed to make it to a studio and lay it down. So I do think there's something to that. It was like the process of, and every studio at that time was owned by someone who was like big shit in the 70s. You know, they when I was going to those studios, it was all dudes who were like 12 years past their prime in like 1978, you know? So I think it was part of this switch between like, you know, recording being this sort of elusive thing that was so hard to get. And then, you know, what we have now, which is like, you know, your laptop.
Yeah, it is an interesting thing. I mean, I wasn't around in the early 80s for that wave of punk rock, you know, like, but you listen to like, you know, the records that I like from that era, like, you know, Adolescence and Agent Orange and Social D and TSOL and all that stuff. And those records to my ear still sound really good.
Right. TSOL records sound great, dude.
You put on like, I don't know, like a No Use for a Name record from the early 90s. It doesn't sound so good. You know? What happened?
I mean, well, for reference, like where was the first like No Use for a Name music recorded?
I don't even know. You know, I mean, I didn't come in until 95. So Nate had already had a few records under their belt.
Right.
But, But it is funny, kind of what you're saying. I do remember that being a thing. Like, oh yeah, man, this used to be like Boz Skaggs Studio,
right?
I remember those kind of rooms being around.
They all had one claim to fame, right? Like somebody who graced that studio about 13 years before.
This was the recording console that Lynyrd Skynyrd's Freebird was recorded on.
Yeah, totally. Why are there all these Tommy Two Tone gold records on the wall? Right. Dude, his cousin used to engineer this shit.
Well, speaking of which, who and what was Legion of Doom?
How do you even know about that?
Come on. I go for the cuts, dog.
Wow, that is like, that can't be on my Wikipedia page, but
it is not. No, I'm gonna check.
Legion of Doom was a band that that I was in for a minute in 10th grade. Nice. And it was the second band I was ever in. The first one was called The Lost Kittens. And Legion of Doom was me and my friend Mark. And my friend Jeff played drums, and my friend Chris Gillette played bass. And we did I think we did one gig, but it was quite a gig. And it was a gig that in some ways, you know, really like had a huge impact on me, because we were the first band. This was the first like club gig I ever did. There was like this, this pool hall in Santa Barbara called Golden Eagle Pool Hall.
Nice.
And the lineup, this is a fucking sick lineup. It was Legion of Doom, Rat Pack, who I was not in, but soon became the bass player in, and they were like local Santa Barbara punk rock band that had a 7-inch on Mystic Records and everything, and
okay, you know,
and that was cool. And then NOFX, I want to say it was NOFX's first gig in Santa Barbara, and then they at least a couple of them moved to Santa Barbara for a little while, so that would have been my first encounter with NOFX, and Dave Casillas was in Rat Pack at the time. And then after that, he joined NOFX.
Right.
And the headliner was that band Excel.
Oh.
So that was like not only my first club gig, but I would guess that had to have been the first like proper punk rock gig I ever went to.
Wow. Legion of Doom you guys were one for one.
Yeah, I think there was a brief. We had a brief reunion a couple of years later, but it didn't last long. I think we played like one kegger out in IV, and that was it.
Oh, it's so funny.
Legion of Doom didn't get to record in a shitty recording studio.
No, but Legion of Doom did make a really shitty Fostex 4-track demo.
Nice.
I do remember that, and I wish I might have that cassette in a box somewhere. I don't know, but I remember that was the first time I figured out that if you just take the cassette out and just put it in like a regular cassette player and you listen to it. See, I had no concept of mixing at that point.
Right. Yeah.
So you just put it on and it only plays like two of the four tracks, cause the other two are like on the other side. Right. And you're like, what the fuck? Where'd everything go? That doesn't sound like what we did.
Right. And one is left and one is right. And it's like, this sounds like the first Ramones record.
Yeah. It's insane.
Mixing was just volume at that point. Right.
Yeah.
So what was the connection between, you know, the years from those years to you, you know, getting a job at Fat and getting involved in that scene? Like, what was that jump like?
There were a lot of years between those years. So yeah. I moved to LA at the beginning of 1990 with a couple of friends, and like our high school band kind of moved down there. It was me and Luke that was the singer in Lost Kittens, singer guitar player.
Okay.
And one of my bestest friends. And we moved down to LA, like, you know, to try to like make it. And what we didn't count on or didn't understand was that like rock and roll had completely died.
Oh, Jesus.
Like, cause we moved there at the beginning of 90 and it was in that weird gray period between like, you know, all the sort of Sunset Strip rock and roll thing was really dead. And the next thing was kind of bubbling up, but wasn't 100% there yet. You know?
Right. Right.
So, then I lived in LA for like, you know, about like 5 years or so. And like during that time in the early 90s, like, you know, I mean, you guys were around, like music just changed a lot. And, and the punk rock thing was, you know, I think of like it was really like Bad Religion and Social D coming back around.
Right.
The late 80s that really kind of like kick that whole thing off, and then NoFX turning into a really good band, you know, by the early, late 80s, early 90s, you know. So that whole thing was going. And I grew up with Joey from Lagwagon. And so I was sort of a spectator of it, you know.
I see. Yeah.
Wait, Joey was from Santa Barbara too?
Yeah, yeah. Joey's from Santa. Lagwagon's from Santa Barbara. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know you grew up there. That's okay.
Oh yeah. No, Joey, when we were kids, was like, he was a few years older than me, and he had a car, and and he was just like he just always had the latest best record. Like, nice. Whatever the latest best record was, he had it, and we were listening to it in his car. So he was awesome. Like, I mean, Joey really had like a gigantic influence on, I think, a lot of people from Santa Barbara, musically, you know?
That's cool.
Yeah. And certainly did on me, but like, he was like, in a lot of ways, he was like a huge gateway to, like, you know, I'd go with him to shows down in LA all the time and stuff like that. But, but yeah, so we were pals, and I sort of like, you know, I was never like close friends with Fat Mike or anything through those years, or like when, you know, when NoFX was in Santa Barbara and after that, but I got to know him really through Joey eventually. And, there was a point in, what year was it? It was 94 or so, where me and Joey were talking about putting together a band, and he, you know, it'd be like his side band, for him.
Right,
but I wasn't in a band. Like, I moved to LA and I played around in bands and did that whole thing for a while, and like never got a record deal. And then there was a point there where I was working at the House of Blues in the publicity department, and working a lot and not playing in a band, and kind of not super stoked on life, you know?
Yeah, right.
And Joey was like, dude, why don't you move? Let's move to San Francisco. I don't know where Joey was living at that point, but he was like, let's move to San Francisco and get an apartment. We'll put this band together. I was like, fuck yeah.
Just for reference, how old are you at this point?
Well, this was the beginning of 95, so I was 23 still.
Gotcha. Okay.
So, you know, I mean, I'd been out of the house for a minute. I was like an adult. And right about that same time is when Joe Sib was in that band Wax, and they were, had a song blown up on the radio, and they were going out on the road with Mighty Mighty Boston. So I went out for this month-long tour roading for Wax.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah, it was killer. It was Wax first, Face to Face, and Mighty Mighty Boston's headlining. And it was like a month long. And that was my first time ever on the road. And I was so fucking jealous of, like, I was green with envy at that point that, like, all my friends were touring. And
your brother, too, not only, right?
No, this was so at that point, he wasn't in Face to Face.
Oh,
this
okay.
Was,
okay.
That, and there's a funny story attached to that, too, that I'll get to. But, like, anyway, I do that tour, and then me and Joey moved up to San Francisco, and through that, he helped me, you know, he put in the good word for me to Mike, and Mike hired me at Fat Records.
Nice.
And I worked there for like a minute, and then that's what led to me joining No Use for a Name, and then, you know, things were off to the races. But when I was in No Use for a Name, like for about the first, you know, probably almost the first year, was the original bass player, Steve, was still in the band, but there was like a lot of tension between him and Tony, and I kind of like got in the middle of that when I joined, and then No Use for a Name like parted ways with Steve, and Matt from Face to Face had left Face to Face, so we got Matt in our band, and Face to Face replaced Matt with my brother. So that's how that came to be.
What beautiful nepotism there.
I know, right?
And is it true when you join No Use for a Name, they just like walked into Fat and you kind of like overheard they needed a guitar player?
Well, I mean, I didn't really overhear. They came in, the three of them, and their guitar player, Ed, had just quit. And it was right after Leche Con Carne came out, and that record was doing really well. And they were buzzing, and they had to leave for a tour. They had like a tour booked, you know, that was started the week after. And they came in and they were like talking to Mike, and Mike comes out and says to the whole office, he goes, hey, look, you know, No Use for a Name's guitar player just bailed, and you know, they needed a guitar player, and they're going on tour, and if anybody knows a guitar player, let me know. Like, they need a guitar player.
Right.
And I just sat there like, fuck. And I didn't want to lose my job. I didn't want to be like, I'll play guitar. Like I had just gotten hired there.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Sure.
And it was cool. Like I was working at Fat Wreck. It was fucking rad. It was like, the epicenter of the scene that I thought was like the coolest thing in the world.
You weren't trying to play yourself out like that.
And it's funny because then Mike, I didn't say anything. And then they left. I don't remember exactly how this happened. Maybe they went to lunch or something. Mike came up to me and goes, "Hey, dude, that's cool that you like. I get it. You don't want to lose your job, or whatever. But I know you're a guitar player, and you should do this. You know."
Oh, cool.
And so he totally gave me the blessing. And then I don't remember how this happened, but maybe they came back in somehow. It got around that I was, you know, in the office that I was going to go try out for them. Like I had to go audition. And one of the other guys that worked in the office came up to me and goes, "Dude, you're so fired, dude. You are so fired. Dude, when Mike finds out that you're going to audition for them, you are fucking fired. You blew it." And I was just fuck you. Yeah, yeah.
But didn't Lagwagon also like need a new guitar player like shortly after that? Didn't they turn over guitar players? What year was that?
They did, yeah, because not too long after that was when Chris Rest joined Lagwagon.
Right, yeah. And so that was probably after you were already in No Use.
Yeah, I was already in No Use at that point, and okay. Like we never even discussed me joining Lagwagon, but I did fill in a couple gigs here and there. I remember, as a matter of fact, the first time I ever toured Brazil was filling in for Chris Flippin because he... Oh, okay. At the last minute couldn't go, and it was like a week-long tour down to Brazil, and so I just, you know, jumped in and subbed,
right,
which was fun and wild.
So when you're working at like House of Blues and you're working at Fat, what was your relationship with the guitar like at that point? Were you, you know, someone who was still plugging away, like trying to improve, or where was that in your life at that time?
It's so funny, man. I would love to sit here and tell you like, well, I was home, you know, working on my craft.
Right. Yeah.
Submitting demonstration tapes to the top artist, you know, like, but I was such a lazy fuck, dude. I just felt I played guitar like, cause it was fun. You know what I mean? Like, right. I mean, honestly, don't get me wrong. Like I wanted to like make it and be in a band and tour and do all that shit. I'm not going to pretend that wasn't a big thrust, but I really became more, I don't know, like I always played my guitar, you know, but like I wasn't really like a songwriter or anything when I was younger. I didn't really start writing songs till like, you know, my late 20s. I started trying to dabble in that, and it was a funny thing because I was like, you know, so late on the freight that I was super self-conscious about it for a long time. I was a fucking lazy jack-off in my youth. I look back at being young, I'm like, God, I wasted so much time sleeping. why did I do that? You know, I could have been fucking doing all this shit. And yeah, now
I'd be like Yngwie Malmsteen now if I just woke up 2 hours earlier.
Yeah, with like fucking like a 1,000 song catalog or some shit. You know what I mean? But I just slept through my 20s and my teenage years when I had all this time. And now I've got like kids and responsibilities and shit. Like I can't be... Yeah, you know.
I would, it's interesting when you do a little research about you, and you know, I've learned a lot more about, you know, the personalities of, you know, the people who play music doing these interviews, and you know, there's some people who you can see because of like the way their life played out, and you're one of them. You just seem like a cool guy to be around. And,
oh, you should interview some of my former bandmates or current ones.
Yes, just go on.
I don't know if I'd get glowing reviews from everybody. Let's just say that it's an acquired taste.
Okay.
I think I've become a worse person to be around the older I've gotten in a lot of ways for lots of people. But I will certainly say that the one thing I did really well and worked hard at really all the time when I was like young and struggling and trying to get there and all that shit was, and I think this is actually, and I'm not trying to be a goofball here, but I think this is really important for like rock and roll and stuff.
Cunnilingus.
I was always, I was cunnilingus, baby. No, I was always the, I mean, and Brad can attest to this. I was always the last guy at the bar, man. Like I was fucking hanging. I hung around, dude.
I was the last guy at the bar.
We were all the last guys at the bar.
You were the last guy there.
So you were the hardest hang. You were the hardest hang. Yeah.
I was, dude, if being in the right place at the right time means something, then, you know, then I was trying to, like, I wasn't consciously trying to do that, but I was out and about and fucking, like, in a way that is so foreign to me now as a 49-year-old man.
Right. Yeah.
I really was like you, cause you gotta be out there, man. You gotta be like in whatever scene is your scene, you gotta be a part of it. You know, sure.
Benny's lawyer, who was once my lawyer, said to me probably the most valuable information. She said, the music business is the people business.
Yeah.
And it's pretty much true of any, she was like, people want to work with people that they like. And it's kind of true of all businesses, but you know, yeah, that's what it comes down to. You got to be around, and you know, and people want to they need to hang out with you.
Well, if you're unlikable, you just better either be making money or be really good, and then you can still have a career.
You can be a lawyer. You can be a fucking lawyer then.
But that is a really big part of it. Like you got to be able to like be in confined spaces with your bandmates over long periods of time and not drive each other nuts. You know, you got to be able to hang in the van and know when to be loud and know when to shut the fuck up and all that stuff those are important lessons that you learn just by doing it.
Benny, I should tell you this, Chris. I saw him punch one of the most famous publicists in the face several times. And this was right during when he first started working with him. You know who Steve Martin is?
Yeah.
He's literally like, you know, he's a monster. He's one of the biggest publicists. And shortly after Chris had joined the Foo Fighters, I watched him pummel Steve several times in the face.
Is this like Fight Club style? Like we all have an understanding, or was this a blow up?
No, it was definitely not a blow up, but it might account for why Steve Martin never gets me any press. No, but see, it's funny. Around the time I moved out to New York, you know, right after I joined Foo Fighters, and I had been boxing a little bit back in San Francisco, and Steve was into boxing, and so he hooked me up with his trainer. When I moved to New York, and we were both training in the same gym, and you know, a lot of gyms like have like white collar fights. So they were having one, and our trainer was like, you guys should fight each other.
I'm sorry. What's a white collar fight? Just for, I'm not sure what you're talking about.
White collar fight is for like hobby boxers like me. You know, they call it, probably comes from like, you know, it's like some Wall Street guys or whatever, like
right.
Going and sparring or whatever. But so we did that, and I'll never forget. There was a funny thing after that. Steve was and of course, you know, I mean, I've worked with Steve for a long time, being in the Foo Fighters and stuff, and he's a friend. And I'm totally not talking shit here, but I am talking shit. So we do it, and I mean, I gotta say, that was the first time I ever fought in like a white collar fight, and it was so much harder than I thought, dude. I was like out of gas right away. You know what I mean? Yeah. Just like, oh fuck, this is hard. And then, I was just starting to date my wife, who's now my wife. At the time, we just barely started dating, and a photographer friend of hers came down to the fight and took these really awesome pictures. And I remember Steve, you know, right after the fight, was like, hey, do you want to write like a story about the fight for, I don't remember what magazine it was, but you know, what is some magazine? I was like, oh, cool. Yeah. So I like wrote a little thing, and I go, here, you know, I have this great shot from the fight, you know, you use this for the article. And it was like, you know, I just looked all like, rah, you know,
And
it was this beautiful, like pro shot. And then I'll never forget, the magazine came out and Steve used a shot of him punching me in the face.
that's
what he ran with it. I was like, oh, you son of a bitch.
It's like vulgar display of power.
Yeah.
That was
a hard lesson in the entertainment business right there.
Speaking of hard lessons, I did see one story, and it alludes to what you were saying before about not everyone thinks you're that cool. And I guess it was a hard lesson, you said, getting chewed out by one of your former bands and band members in Austin, Texas, Yeah. But that's not really a fun story. I don't want to get into that. The thing that it made me think of was, you know, and even with some friends of mine recently and people I play music with, this has been a conversation over the last couple of days, which is, you know, what is the thing, the engines that like make these bands keep going and make them keep going in a happy way and make, you know, people stay engaged in the same goals and engaged. And the one thing from the outside, because I don't know him, it seems like Grohl is kind of just like a great band leader. You know, it seems to always be like happy and engaged members. And I'm just wondering for you, like what's his style of like presenting information and communicating to you all to like make you feel that in that engaged and that happy about what you're doing?
Well, I think, you know, like to get back to the thing you were talking about down in Austin, like that was on a solo tour that right. I did. And, you know, that's a very different dynamic where it's like, right. even though everybody's friends more or less, like, you know, I'm hiring a band.
Sure.
And it's not, and you just said something about everybody being invested in, like, nobody's invested in the same goal
right.
in that situation. So, you know, that was a tense thing that, you know, it was a shitty situation for a lot of reasons because we had like a whole, that was day one of a week of South by Southwest,
okay.
you know,
and then
like a couple weeks later, we had like a 2 week tour of the UK and Scandinavia. So like, I mean, that was a really good, like, that was a good moment for me to have to just like keep my mouth shut, you know, to the best of my ability. Cause I could have, because what I felt like saying in that moment was very different than what I internally, I was going, I could just nuke this whole thing right now.
Yeah.
But then I bet I got all these shows, you know,
right,
I gotta
right.
do, and I got commitments, you know?
See, I kind of eat crow a little bit.
Yeah. Big time. And that's, you know, that's not necessarily a good feeling, especially when you're the guy fucking, you know, paying for the whole thing.
Yeah, right. You know what I mean? Like, I get to pay for this and I get to not say shit. This sucks. Yeah.
So, but you know, as far as Foo Fighters go, I would say a huge thing, and this is true, I think, for any band, like forward motion keeps bands happy, I think. You know, like forward motion, like we're always doing something and building on the past and like, you know, like there's like, you know, knock on wood, like we haven't had, things just seem to kind of get better and better in Foo Fighter land for the band, you know, and right. the way the band's like perceived and commercially and all that stuff. So like, you know, I think Dave does a really good job of, you know, he's a guy that always has like a million crazy ideas and then actually like figures out a way to pull them off. And
right.
And that kind of thing keeps it moving. You know, like I feel like the Foo Fighters have never really stagnated.
Right.
And that's, you know, and, but you know, like it's a big band with a lot of people. There's a lot of moving parts. So, you know, if you're not in the room, you don't necessarily catch everything that's happening. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like
right,
it's not
right.
like I feel like people always ask me questions about it. Like it's like, you know, like there's every day we have a meeting to go over the right, agenda. Right. We're going to do X, Y, and it just doesn't work that way. You know what I mean? Sure. Like if you're there, you're there. And if you're not, you miss it. And that's how it goes.
This is your daily Foos briefing.
Yeah. You know what I mean? So right. like, but I tell you, man, it's a trip right now with all, you know, with the way this year has been. And you know, we had made a new album that was finished and mixed and we were supposed to go on tour and then everything, you know, came to a screeching halt. And then now we're working on putting the album out and it's so strange. You know, I was just talking to somebody about this. Like I'm so in my own bubble. Like I don't really listen to like the radio ever. And
right. Yeah.
I don't, you know what I mean? I don't read the same shit that anybody else is reading. So I have no sense at all of how this new record campaign is being, you know,
right.
met by the public or, you know what I mean? I don't know. Sure. Like it got some good feedback from the SNL thing and that's all good. And it seems like people are pumped on it. So, you know, fingers crossed, but it's a really weird time to make a record because you don't have the immediacy of going out and playing shows to get a sense of anybody likes your new shit or not, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But it's not really like there's anything else going on to distract people from it, like a new record, you know, like things are pretty dead.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah. except for like, you know, Civil War and you know, the pandemic.
You know, there's one. Since we're here with the pandemic, you know that. So Benny and I have been doing this all through the pandemic, and like one recurring theme with a lot of people is like, because it's mostly musicians, you know, is like everybody definitely misses kind of interacting and being on the road, but they also pretty much universally have had this sort of guilty pleasure of being like, oh yeah, it's nice to have a break. Like I'm really digging like staying home and chopping wood or whatever, you know. Is that your experience? I mean, you're a pretty busy guy anyway with like the podcast and your solo stuff, but
yeah, no, totally. Because I mean, if when I sort of think back over the last, you know, many years, because I've been kind of bouncing between, you know, we'll do a Foo Fighter record and do a tour. And like, you know, somewhere in the middle of that, I'll go run out to Nashville and make a record. And then between Foo Fighter stuff, squeeze in some touring. And so I've been really like kind of back to back for a long time now. And it's been really good to be home. Especially with like the age that my kids are all at, you know, is like fantastic. And
what so kind of posse able, you got over there?
I got three boys, 17, 14, and 12.
Oh wow.
And yeah.
You're like a basketball team.
I know. For real. Yeah. Well, you throw my wife in there and you know, that's that we got.
Yeah, you got a starting five right there. Yeah.
Totally. Perfect. Yeah. No, but you know, it's been really good. It's funny. My kids are funny. I always wonder, like, you know, of course they've grown up with me being gone a lot. So right. I think that's just baked into the cake, you know, for mm-hmm. them. But they're just funny. You know, kids are funny. You just don't know what's kind of what's registering with them and what isn't, you know, half the time.
Which one of that crew, like, you know, do any of your kids think what you do is cool or you're just nerdy
not
dad regardless? Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think if anything, at least at this point, like what I do pretty much guarantees that none of them want to go anywhere near playing music, having anything to do with it.
Is that good for you? Okay for you?
I mean, you know, I'm torn. There was, we made them all play piano and guitar and stuff over the years. And there was a moment there, you know, there was a couple moments here and there where I thought, you know, they were all sort of, you know, gonna get into it the way that I did. But, you know, I like at the end of the day, I just want them to have something in their lives that they're as, you know, that they have to have the way that I had to have music, you know? Mm. So that's what I want more than anything. I'm not gonna lie. Would I love it if they were all like, show me how to play that Randy Rhoads lick? Like, of course. Yeah. You know,
sit down. Son.
They're going to be wicked DJs.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, they're all really into music but you know, nobody they listen to hip hop. There isn't a lot of guitar stuff in there. So I have that, you know, what I do is not what's cool to them.
Right.
So Benny, since you brought up the Foos, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to relate my early memories of Chris because we essentially lived together when you joined the band.
Yeah.
And we lived on the sixth floor of a walk-up. Ooh. And you know what? Like what I perceive the biggest perks to being in the Foo Fighters was that the UPS guy had to fucking carry like tons of heavy free swag up the stairs. Do you remember all the shit that you got during like that first year?
Yeah, those are the good old days when you would just get like a giant duffel bag filled with all the latest Hurley stuff or whatever. You know,
right.
Duffel bag, dude. He brought up like a fucking karaoke machine.
You know, Brad, I'll tell you something funny. I never realized in those years that you could have the guy that drove the car service carry your bag up. Like, I didn't know that was a thing. And so I would come home from tour with like my biggest suitcase just filled with shit that I'd collected from wherever we've been and have to fucking like pull it up that, you know what I didn't know back then when I lived in New York? How stupid is this? I'm such a like West Coast ding dong for not ever figuring out. I didn't know you could get your groceries delivered. Yeah. I would walk to the market that was like 4 or 5 blocks away and then carry bags full of groceries home and then have to carry them up those fucking 6 flights of stairs.
The stairs were brutal. They were definitely brutal. I felt bad for that poor guy. He also brought up you like an electric scooter. Do you remember this shit?
Yeah.
And then what did Chris do with all this stuff? You used it to pay off, like, you paid people with it.
We're not supposed to talk about this out loud.
Oh, this is a long time ago. I think you're free here, right? This is, this is long enough.
I'm not mentioning any brand names.
Hey, it all went into the black market. That's right.
I think somebody painted your room and got the karaoke machine for it.
It could happen.
Whatever. You should sell that stuff. I mean, it's crazy. You know, the bigger and bigger Gaslight got, like, the freer shit got, and it never made any sense to me. You know, I'm like, I have fucking money now. Yeah. You know, where the hell were you young people and 5 broke, years ago? Like,
when you really needed a karaoke machine, nobody was giving
it to you. No karaoke machine.
That's right. That's right. Where are all the free guitars when you're 16?
Exactly.
You know?
I guess you have to earn that stuff. What a load of shit. So I wanted to talk to you, I mean, a little bit about like your solo stuff. Now, Brad, did you have anything else from the old days?
Sure.
I'm going down memory lane.
Is it time for our mystery friend?
We got a mystery friend?
So mystery friend is when we essentially prompt you for a story that neither of us were at. And you give us, fill us in, and then you need to guess who the mystery friend is who told us the story.
Okay. So, all right. Can I guess before I hear the story?
Yeah. Oh, shit, yeah. No.
I'm just going to go with Johnny T.
No.
He just seems like the obvious candidate.
I would not put you on the spot, buddy.
All right, because, you know.
Once this turns off, I'm asking stories about whoever the fuck Johnny T is, because that sounds fun.
This story, all I have is a graveyard party in Prague.
Oh, yes. Now I know who told you the story. I absolutely know who told you the story.
I'm sure you do.
But yeah, that was on a No Use for Name tour of Europe in 1997. To this day, one of the greatest tours, like funnest tours I've ever done. Definitely the only one I've ever done quite like that. I remember we were over there for 42 days and did 39 shows.
Woo!
And we went everywhere, and a third of that was in Germany. So, I mean, we went to like every small town in Germany that you can imagine. but that night we wound up in a graveyard in Prague. And the best part of that story, I mean, it was super fun. We were all fucked up, you know, running around. It was like me and probably a couple guys from No Use for Name and a few of the guys from Swingin' Utters. And I don't remember if Suicide Machines were there or not, but we like went into this creepy old graveyard and took all these photos with like in the tombs and all this stuff. But all we had was like some shitty, remember those like disposable cameras from back then?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So we got all the photos developed, and it was just our faces, like brightly lit with the flash, and you couldn't see the background at all.
Right, yeah.
So there's really no proof of any of it. But okay, so if I have to guess who told you that, I'm going Max Huber.
I know,
because he was there.
Yes,
it could have been John Bush too, because he was there too.
No, you got it. It was Max. I thought I had a lock on you though, dude, because you know who I met this morning for the first time?
Who?
Justin J.
What? And you met Justin for the first time?
Yeah, and I'm going to give him some props.
How's that possible?
Anyway, I don't know. I don't think I've ever met him before. I mean, Kath obviously has and has known him for a long time, but yeah, I just met him for the first time this morning. His kids go to my school.
I know. That's crazy.
All right, so maybe you would have guessed him. I hit him up for a mystery friend. And I just hit him up too late. I thought this would be the one.
But I was actually just on his podcast. He has a fantastic podcast too called The Plug.
Yeah, we should plug The Plug.
Plug The Plug.
Because I did hit him up and it looks good. He's got some really cool, diverse guests that I'm definitely going to check out some of those shows.
Brad, what's going on in this high school? Your kids go to school in. You have all this web of connections via school. Man. Is this what you pay for living in tiny apartments in New York?
It's a public school.
Yeah.
I tell you, man, school parent life at your kid's school is such a trip.
Oh, it really is. Can you guys give me any tips actually while I'm here? So I'm just cracking this for the first time, right? Like my kids are 3 and 5. They're both in the same program. And I'm just starting to see these communities form. You know what I mean? The emails are coming.
Yep.
You know, they're asking for some stuff from time to time. What is the approach here? Because I feel like being totally, you know, totally mute and totally black is rude and does nothing good for your kid. But I'm getting the sense that if I go too far in, I might not ever get out.
So here's what I learned over time.
What's the balance?
When you first have kids, you're like, oh my God, it's a miracle. Look at our little miracle. And you start taking your kid to like baby group. That's the first thing. Mm. And you meet all these other parents and they're all like, we have our little miracle. And everybody's like, yay. And you're super open and you just want to become friends with everybody and talk about your kids. And mm-hmm. that pretty much keeps going like all through preschool. You're like, can you believe these little geniuses, you know, and all that shit. And you make all these friends and pretty soon, like 99.9% of those friendships just fall by the wayside. Cause then all your kids wind up going to different schools
right.
And then you just don't see any of those folks anymore. And then you get into elementary school, and in elementary school, at least the one that like my kids went to, you're still very involved and you go in and you know the teachers and you meet all the other parents and you sit around. So then you have all those relationships, right? And those,
right.
And you're still pretty open at that point, but you're starting to get a little cynical about the whole thing. You know, like
you're right,
preschool
right.
has started to wring you out a little bit.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Okay.
And through elementary school, you know, you're still kind of like in it. By the time my oldest son got to junior high, I was beginning to get a little checked out of the whole like, yay, we're all parents together thing.
Right.
You know, like,
you're like, I don't need this community.
Yeah. And it's funny because I kind of found like, well, it's not so much I don't need this community. We did make a lot of really good friends.
Sure.
And like our kids go to a K-12. So like, it's a great school and we love it and all that stuff. But I think that you're so fired up when your kids are young and you're first going through it that like we found like we knew my oldest son's grade of parents pretty well. And then it's sort of diminishing returns for, you know, the younger you get. And like my youngest son, I didn't know any of those parents.
Right,
like,
right.
You'd go to like the sixth grade school project and you'd be like, I don't know half these people. How have I never, we've been in school for 6 years together. Like, I don't know who any of these people are. All that said, then when you know, once your kids get into middle school, then you stop being kind of involved in that way. You just drop them off and you don't go in and you don't, and then you really miss it. Then you're like, fuck, I don't know my kids' teachers. I don't see any of my old parent friends, you know? And you're like, and so you spend that last little part of elementary school kind of like grinding. And then when it's gone, you're like, oh shit, that's gone.
Mm.
And it ain't coming back. But I'll tell you what I did do a lot through the elementary school years that was great. And I highly recommend it. And that is fucking parent band. If your school has one, do it. We had a great parent band at my kid's school. Cause you know, it's LA and you got all these musicians and, you know, and even some like actors that are musicians and then just a bunch of parents that are hobby musicians, you know, and everybody was pretty good. And we would do like a big gig once a year. And those were always really, really fun. And I always kind of like looked a little crossways at the parents that didn't do it. Like, why isn't the singer from Muse in the fucking parent band, man? What do you got better than you? You know?
Oh, good for us, you know?
Yeah. Oh, you can't come play the fucking Bruno Mars song at the assembly, huh, bud? Yeah. Okay.
Look, I play stadiums too, asshole. You know?
Chris, you're going to love this, but So a couple of years ago, the principal who has we've got like the parent band. We do like fundraisers. He actually organized a battle of the parent band for the East. So for the last, like, I think we did it for the last 3 years. Actually, that was my last night out before they locked down everything for COVID. Was the battle of the parent bands, and we won for the first time in 3 years.
You won. You really? Took it.
Yeah,
reigning champion, wow. Man. Fucking. What sick of it all song did you play?
What are you doing? Scratch the Surface? That was Injustice System?
We did a bunch of like fucking like total like 60s, 70s jam rock tunes. And
nice.
It was interesting.
Nice. But interesting.
Were you drinking IPAs on stage?
Of course.
Of course. Cold IPA for all my gigs.
But Benny, if it happens, next time it happens, you're going to have to come judge, because that's the thing, is I always tap my, you know, quasi celebrity and industry friends to come be judges at it.
I'll do it for you. I had one experience judging a battle of the bands, and I think I'm out.
Oh, shit.
I think I'm out. Even though I honestly quite dug a few bands. And
it's more fun than you would think, because
there's a couple things I found from it that make me not really equipped. Okay. And A is like the people who seem like this idea, they gave you a microphone after every band, like you were supposed to fucking critique them after.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, there is zero chance I'm sitting up here in front of a bunch of people critiquing these fucking bands. You crazy? I'm like, I'll give them a score, but I'm not telling these kids like what to do. You know what I mean? Like, I'll never present myself in that way. Well, and that's
the battle of the parents bands. It's fundraiser. It's all for fun. And you just be positive. You just say some nice things.
Is there pizza? Pizza?
Dude, I'll get pizza for you. For all right. Sure.
Is that, do you think that, is that like born out of like American Idol culture or something?
I'm sure it is. Well, hasn't there always been like Battle of the Bands? I mean, I remember doing
of like trying to get Benny to like, well, you know, I felt like your presentation was a little off. And
yeah, probably. You're probably right. It was. I think it was post that. Like they used to just hang, like, you know, pick up a scorecard, like the NBA slam dunk competition.
The judges are the most famous people in the room. You know what I mean? We've got a few quasi celebrities in some of the bands. Definitely no Foo Fighters and no Muse people, but
I'll do it via Zoom if you want.
That would be the way the next one gets done.
There's only one guy. I got to be honest though, I did nail one person in my judging, okay? And it was cuz the guy he was playing in this like three piece that kind of sounded like Motorhead or something. It was real fast. Every riff was like down to down to down down to down to down down to down, you know, those cool like hot beats and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, homeboy was a tapper. Tap, tap, tapper. You know, he was barely hitting his drums. And then I saw him complaining to, you know, some 16-year-old sound kid about the levels of his monitors, and that's the reason he couldn't play well and stuff. And that's the only guy I gave the business to when I was on the microphone. And I said to him, basically, just like, listen, fella, if you can't hear it right now and you can't get through this experience, you're not going to do it. You're not going to do it, kid. You know, you can't pull it off at Porta Pizza in downtown Jersey City. You're not going to pull it off at, like, you know, a squat in Hamburg or something like that, wherever you got to go next.
Nice job.
Yeah, that's a funny thing. I think about that sometimes, like that. And I don't remember this exactly, but there must have been, you know, when you first start playing gigs, you don't have monitors. There's no sound for stage or anything, you know? And then you hit that point where you start playing in clubs where they're like, hey, what do you want in your wedge? You're like,
I don't know.
Can I get the hi-hat in there? Like, you're like, right. You're asking for the wrong shit.
Yeah.
Just the DI off the bass. Or whatever. I don't know. You know, like, just some wrong shit. Like, it's funny, but that really is it's an important part of performing that nobody ever really talks about that much, is your onstage mix.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That is something that should be, that would be cool to like, what's that being said, what's your mix like on stage? What do you like to hear?
It's different in different things, you know. Okay. In Foo Fighters, I need, because there's like 800 of us on stage and we're louder than a fucking jet plane. I need a lot of kick and snare.
Okay.
So that I'm, you know, that I'm keeping it together. Like, I really am listening mostly to Dave's vocal and Taylor's kick and snare.
Okay.
And in addition to that, I have a lot of me and not a lot of anybody else.
Right.
You know, because I just start getting confused.
Sure.
I start losing, you know, where I'm at, or, you know, losing where the one is sometimes. If in those, in, you know, in big venues, it's like cavernous and you get like sounds bouncing around and shit. So I just like a lot of kick and snare, Dave's vocal and my guitar.
Are you on like inner ear systems for Foo Fighters?
No, I tried that for a little while and we're just so loud. Like, I didn't feel like it was good because all I was doing was just turning it up really loud.
Yeah,
and I
thought, right.
It's probably like worse for my hearing long run.
Yeah.
You know? So I wear earplugs and I crank it up in my wedge and that's about it. But like when I'm going out and doing solo gigs, if I'm playing in a bar, you know, I play little, you know, small little bars and shit. So, and they usually have crappy PAs. So I pretty much usually just put my vocal through it and let everything else come off the stage. And then if it's, you know, if I'm playing a solo gig and it's somewhere that actually sounds good and has a good PA, then I'll, you know, just kind of like put a little bit of everything in there.
Yeah. Start adding a couple of things.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about that with your solo shows. Like, you know, like, as you said, a Foo Fighters show is it's a fucking freight train, you know? And I know you really try to harness kind of a different environment for your shows. So how do you like peel it back and keep it simpler? And do you ever have to like catch yourself? Like you're in kind of like Foo Fighters mode and you're trucking forward and you gotta be like, no, like chill out.
It's honestly, it's a work in progress. Like, because besides Foo Fighters, I just always played in really loud bands with big, loud guitars and everything screaming. And for my solo stuff, if I'm playing with a full band, you know, it just doesn't sound as good if it's all too revved up, you know? I've gotten more and more comfortable, playing it more laid back and definitely playing it quieter and, you know, where you can like hear your vocal and stuff more. But I tell you, one of the best things I ever did was, a couple of years ago, I started playing a lot of acoustic shows, just me and an acoustic guitar.
Okay.
And that'll keep you honest.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
That'll really keep you honest. That exposes the weaknesses real clear.
I mean, as far as what do you think that exposes the most, vocally or?
Oh, vocally for sure. And, you know, it helped me a lot to become a better singer because I was always a really shitty singer and I always wanted to be a better singer. And I was, and really the biggest problem for me, you know, you just kind of got the voice that you got, but, you know, and sort of within that, then you can try to like learn a little bit of technique or whatever to help. And I would just, when I first started singing, I was doing everything wrong, just tight, screaming, hunching my shoulders up, putting everything through my throat. Just like if it was wrong, I was doing it. You know what I mean? Right. And it was because I was so, I just wasn't relaxed. So playing the acoustic shows, like it just, you can't hide and you have to like breathe and fucking push from your gut and do all that stuff that is going to make it sound a little better. So I've come full circle on it where I love doing those shows now. And I never did. And I always wanted to. So I just started doing a lot of them.
That's
and it
cool.
was really, really super humiliating at times, but it helped. I feel like, you know,
That's
and it
cool.
certainly helped in the sense of just like getting comfortable in my own shoes, you know?
Sure. Yeah. I was going to ask you about that. You know, you made a pretty, you know, hard pivot, you know, from the outside, you know, from the worlds you were in to kind of the world you find yourself in now with your solo stuff. When you were kind of doing that and making that turn, were you nervous about like the acceptance from your peers in you know, the new world and more of a songwriter country kind of world? And how did you reconcile that, like, personally?
Yeah. I mean, it definitely, I don't know. I don't know if I ever worried too much about like, I guess you kind of do worry about what people think a little bit, but like, I just knew I wasn't very good. You know, I knew I just knew I wasn't very good. I knew I wasn't a very good songwriter, and I knew I wasn't a very good singer. And I knew when I went out and played, it just wasn't very good. Like, I just, if I'm being honest, I just knew that.
Okay.
Cause I was pretty good at guitar, you know, and I was in like a really good band, and I'd been in other good bands. And so I knew what good sounded like. I knew that I was not good, you know, I just knew it, you know? And so a lot of it was just, you know, kind of woodshedding and like just trying to be a better songwriter and work on some of the other stuff and try to just get more comfortable and with the performing side of it, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I love the rush of it. I love the thrill, you know. I love like when I go do my solo thing, it's like the closest thing that I still have to feeling like I'm in ninth grade playing my talent show, where you're kind of like, I hope this fucking works.
right, you know.
yeah, I don't know. I just, that's like the part that I dig about it is just the evolution, you know?
Have you found like the country scene? I know you played like the Grand Ole Opry and did stuff like that. Have you found that world like pretty accepting and open?
I mean, yeah, yes and no. Like, I mean, I'm not going to pretend that like I'm successful as a solo artist. I've gotten to know like a lot of people in Nashville and a lot of people in not only in like the Americana world, but like, but in the mainstream country world too. And people are cool, you know, that Nashville's a crazy town of just incredible depth musicianship, you know, like, and I mean that on all fronts, like the fucking greatest songwriters and the just absolute best players.
Oh yeah. You go to karaoke in Nashville and you're like, Jesus Christ. Like,
yeah. And it's humbling. And I sort of come, you know, I've been lucky because I'm in a popular band that I can kind of come in through the side door and you know, I don't kid myself. Like if I was just Joe Schmo moving to Nashville to try to make it, I wouldn't make it. I'm not good enough. You know, like I'm not even going to pretend that I am, you know what I mean? Like, But no, people out there, you know, I've got a lot of good friends out there now and I dig it. I dig all those scenes, you know. I think there's something to be said for the range of country music.
Yeah, it's a
really interesting thing, you know. I've always noticed this, like country music people all musicians kind of love everything, you know, but like country music people really are like, know all about rock and roll and everything. Rock and roll people think that all of country music is Toby Keith. Yeah. It's fucking weird. And right, like, it's like one of the last things that you can sort of like beat up on and make fun of. And I feel like for most of the time, I mean, every genre has its schlocky shit and it's pop and it's whatever. But like, I honestly feel like country music is really kind of misunderstood, like the depth and the quality of just like the art form, you know. It really, it's a very different thing than rock music or any other genre. And it's, I just feel like it gets sneered at a lot by people that don't really know what the fuck they're talking about.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah. I'd agree with you. It's
interesting. It does, mainly because, you know, the audience, I think now, and also modern country is 80s pop, right?
Yeah. A lot of it, sure. Yeah, but I mean, what's modern rock?
Yeah, it's the same shit.
It's like, what's the difference?
I listen to those modern country songs and I'm like, this is just the same song I heard on rock radio with like a slide. And that's it.
Yeah, and even a lot of times they don't even bother with like the little banjo overdub or whatever. Right. You know what I mean? Yeah. Nowadays, but whatever. There's a lot of stuff in modern country that I think is fucking great though too. I mean, I love it. Like Eric Church, Brothers Osborne. Whatever. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's good. My point is, it's just like any genre. You know, I don't like most of any genre, but the good stuff is fucking great. And, you know,
it's interesting. Yeah.
Country is still the home of the song, you know, like that's really
100%.
That's what you can't, you know, if you know anything about music, you can't make fun of country because it's still, you know, it's like, that's what rock is. Rock is the rhythm of like blues and kind of that rawness and the fucking songwriting of country. Like that's what we listen to now on pop radio.
It's interesting.
Well, you know, I defy you to like spend a little time with Merle Haggard's catalog and then say country music is shit. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's just, I don't know. I mean, but whatever. It's just music. It's just all, you know, opinion and what you do.
I think it's got something to do with exposure too. It's one of the unique things about country is, you know, I'm born and raised in Central Jersey and by New York City, and fuck, like I can't find a country song on the radio. You know, like I cruise through and I don't even see one. And then when I start touring, you know, and I'm not very far. I'm like 3-4 hours south. Now I'm in Maryland. And all of a sudden there's a bunch of fucking country songs on the radio and it's kind of part of the narrative. And somehow, you know, for whatever reasons, I think country music kind of got maybe politicized, you know, where, you know, for people from the Northeast or something, all you think about is a Confederate flag, you know, all you think about is something like that. And it kind of got put into that box. And then it's just this blanket, like, yeah, whatever, you know? So I do think a lot of it for people, at least from where I'm from, it's just exposure. I don't even think they have an opinion, you know? It's like not even a formed opinion about it. They just don't even know about it.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
I will tell you, it was really funny when my kids were really young. They just kind of listened to my records and they kind of went through phases of like, you know, there was like a long Kiss phase, you know, there was like a Green Day phase, you know, there was like a Hives phase, an AC/DC phase, you know, they just kind of went through that stuff and they were really into it. And we'd get in the car and they'd be like, play I Was Made for Loving You or whatever, you know? and then if I tried to play anything country, like my kids didn't know what genre was, you know?
Right.
They were too young, you know, to really understand what the genre differences were. But the second I would put on something like a Buck Owens song or something, they'd be like, no country. They just had this like visceral hatred of country music. Huh. Right? And it wasn't from lack of exposure because I exposed them to it. You know what I mean? Like, it is so funny, weird. Man. Like they instantly hated it. Which I always thought
there's
funny.
Something in the Matrix about it, I guess.
Let me ask you this because I mean, now they're teenagers, so they probably hate everything, but like, I mean, I saw you with Dead Peasants, right? I think the first time that you must not have been doing it for very long. That time in Austin, remember I drove out, you had this gig out in the middle of nowhere and I drove you back to the city. I had a minivan cause I was down there working.
Yeah. When we were down there for South by Southwest?
Yeah. Probably. Like the Foos were playing that night, but I didn't really realize what I knew you were doing a solo thing. I had no idea what it was. And I went out there and I was like, oh fuck. I was like, oh, Chris is like Mescalero. It's like, he's just doing this as he's got a great band and he's like, just trying to like have a blast with it. And it was fun. I mean, I like a lot of this, you know, I like the stuff you covered and I like the band stuff, but I got to say, like, I'm going to blow some smoke, dude. This new record, I really like it. I watched the video when it came out and then I just kind of let it go. But before, you know, when you said you were going to come on the show, I went and listened to the whole thing and I really like this record and I can't figure out totally why. Because I can't totally figure out what it is, but it sounds really cool. And I just wondering if your kids like it because it's a little more refined. It doesn't sound as hokey, maybe.
No, they don't like it at all. Right. It's funny. like with the Dead Peasants thing, you know, we like, I didn't grow up listening to country and had never played country. And so when we were doing the Dead Peasants thing, we were just a cover band for a few years. Cause I was like, I just want to play these songs that I like and try to figure out how to play them, you know, and how to be comfortable playing them. And, you know, it's not like we were trying to be like, some like, you know, refined, smooth, real vintage country band. We're just kind of like doing it like, you know, what does Buck Owens sound like played by a bunch of guys that grew up listening to Kiss, you know what it sounds like? And that kind of thing. But then with the last couple solo records I've done, you know, I've definitely like, you know, those aren't cover records, you know, and I've put a lot more effort into them and a lot more effort into the songwriting. And then, you know, working with Dave Cobb out there, it's like, that has a huge impact on it, you know?
Okay.
And you know, it's not like those records aren't like country records per se. They're just kind of like country rock or country influence, whatever, you know, it's Americana, whatever you want to call it. But yeah, no, that definitely didn't win me any points with my kids. And it's funny because one of the songs on my last record, I wrote about my son like having his first girlfriend, and it's totally like not the truth or anything.
Right,
I was just sort of
right.
inspired by that moment. And I don't think he thought that was too hip at all.
He'll appreciate that later in life.
Totally. Well, that's the funny thing. Like, that's what I'm assuming is going to happen, because it's kind of what happened to me with a lot of my dad's records. Is like, I hated the music my dad listened to. And then when I hit like, you know, I don't know, 25, somewhere in there, I was like, whoa, dad listened to like, he had good records.
Yeah, man, fuck. Yeah, yeah.
Stevie Wonder was actually better than the shit that I was listening to. You know?
I know.
Bob Marley was actually pretty damn good, you know? Yeah. Like, I had a classic
moment with my dad where I was like listening to like a Kiss record, and he, you know, came in and looked at it and was like, what is this? Why do they have to dress up? You know, and like, and then he said something like, you know, Chuck Berry can play a lead while he's doing a split and bending over and touching his head to the stage. And I'm like, whatever, dad, get out of here. And I'm like 12 years old. He leaves the room, and you know what I did? I went over to the Chuck Berry record and I pulled it out, and I'm like,
no shit,
there's the picture of him doing the split and touching his head. And I was like, holy shit, this is fucking cool as hell.
I tell you a parental music moment that I never forgot, and I giggle about it still, is I remember being a kid and waiting and waiting for the new Ozzy Osbourne video to come on MTV. And it was Bark at the Moon.
Yeah. You know? Right.
And this was his first record post Randy Rhoads.
Right.
Randy Rhoads was like our fucking idol. And we were like so pumped and waiting for it. And I remember it came on MTV, and my mom was sitting on the couch behind me. And I was just like, I was like practically crying. I was so stoked, you know? But inside, I knew it was fucking ridiculously shitty. Like, I knew it. Like, I couldn't bring myself to admit it, but it was like, he's in a fucking tree dressed as a werewolf. It's like the dumbest thing. It's so not scary, you know what I mean? And my mom just sat on the couch laughing her ass off.
Oh my God.
And I was so pissed. Fuck you, mom. You don't get it.
You don't understand.
Fucking Ozzy, man.
Oh, that's too classic. Good. All right. There's something I got to you know, it makes more sense that you mentioned that you did some boxing, because I couldn't for the life of me understand, like, out of, you know, I'm looking at your list of podcasts. I'm seeing like Lucinda Williams and, you know, all these great artists. And then out of nowhere, I'm like, Manny Pacquiao. Like, where the fuck did that come from? You know? And then I listened to a little of the episode. Yeah. So please, just walk me through, like, that must have been just a ridiculously weird situation. Can you tell me what it's like going to his house and like what's happening over there?
I mean, I've been around a lot of celebrities or whatever over the years, but I've never seen anything like Manny Pacquiao's house and his entourage, and the way that the whole thing sort of worked was like, I mean, it was something else, man. I mean, it was really fun because I'm a huge fan and a huge boxing fan. And, you know, I've been lucky to, like, you know, I interviewed Robert Garcia before Freddie Roach and, you know, some people.
Cool.
And boxing's a funny world because, like, even like at Church Street, like where Brad was talking about coming to that fight, like, you know, when you hang out in almost any boxing gym, especially in a big city, you know, like, pro fighters come through there. So it's not like other sports. Like, you can encounter the best fighter in the world on any given day at fucking Church Street. You know, and he might be doing a public workout or press workout or some shit like that, you know, in a way that you're not going to necessarily run into fucking Tom Brady or whatever. You know?
Yeah, like, I'm not going to see LeBron at the YMCA. Yeah,
exactly. You know what I mean? And you get those moments in boxing. It's fucking cool. But yeah, so I know Manny's publicist, and he hooked up the interview, and I went over there, and
this was in New York or LA or
no, this was in LA. This was in LA.
So he has like his own compound in LA too.
Yeah, he's got a house, you know, in LA, and I've never seen so many people like in an entourage.
It's
like, I swear to God, it almost seemed like people were walking in off the street to take selfies with him. Like, people would just walk up to him to say, hey, can I take a picture? And he'd take a picture, but it was like, it was like you were on the sidewalk outside of your hotel room, like not like in your house. It was the fucking weird.
Okay.
And I go over there and I've got my little, you know, my mics and my laptop and I was kind of like, okay, we're not going to, you know, just hold on, just hang on a minute. You know, and my man, he's not ready. And he's kind of like doing a photo shoot or something. He's like, okay, you know, Manny wants you to have lunch with him. And so we all go sit down. There's like 100 of us at some table and I'm not like having a conversation with him or anything, you know, and he's over there and all these people and we have lunch and eventually, I interviewed him, and while I was interviewing him, there would just be like people would come up and like film it and like stick their cameras in your face and his face, and there's people ever. It was so unlike, like that's like the exact opposite of every other interview I've ever done, you
right,
know,
where right.
You and the person. It was like so much energy in the room, and he was really nice, but like, you know, he's a pro. Like he definitely wasn't. He didn't go there. I tried to get him to go there on a couple of things and he was not taking the bait. So he was cool. But, and then at one point they had told me to bring a guitar and I think I wound up like, it was so weird. I think I played him a song at one point, you know, and while I'm playing him the song, I'm like, you know, maybe Manny Pacquiao knows who the Foo Fighters are. Like he probably does. Right. I don't know if he's a fan or anything, but he definitely don't, he ain't listening to no fucking Chris Shiflett songs.
Wait, did he like demand a song? Like you play for me now?
No. Oh, okay. I mean, not really. I play him a song, you know, here, you know? And so I'm sitting there playing like, I grew up in a West Coast town. I'm just thinking like, he doesn't give a shit about this. Like, come on, what are we doing? And then I think he played my guitar a little bit too. And then,
he jammed a little?
A little bit, yeah. And it was like a 4-hour day, you know?
Wow.
It was like, it was nuts. It was cool, man. I'll never forget it. That's for sure. Definitely the weirdest interview I've ever done until this one.
Yeah. I mean, he's essentially like, you know, he might be like the president of the Philippines soon. So,
right.
You're
connected.
This might branch you into like, you know, more of a political journalism career now, Chris.
If you see me become like the Filipino minister of kick-ass rock and roll, you'll know where that came from.
I do believe that's a cabinet position. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
It could be. Could be.
It is down there. Yeah.
What's so when you're at home, like with a, you know, a number of kids, what's like what's a Foo Fighters songwriting process like? You know, like in what shape do you get songs and when do you get to start like putting your work on them?
Well, usually Dave will go record a bunch of ideas,
okay.
You know, and he'll just make demos just by himself, or maybe him and Taylor will get together and record a bunch of demos or whatever. So usually at some point there's like, you know, you'll get like a you know, nowadays, it used to be a CD and nowadays it's like a Dropbox.
Right.
Like, here's 25 new ideas, you know, and normally we'll like jam on them and they'll evolve. This new record we would sort of jam on them right before we would record them for most of them.
Okay.
So there's a little less like pre-production stuff, and then it's really just like most of the time it will start with Dave will lay down a guitar track, just a scratch track, and Taylor will get a drum part, you know, get a drum track going. And then we just start building off that. Usually Dave will put his guitars on there and then I'm usually next, or Pat, you know, either me or Pat usually goes next. And then Nate is in there and then Rami, and then Dave will put vocals on it usually last. And that process is usually about a week per song.
Oh, wow.
It's kind of what it works out to, you know? And yeah, so like when I'm putting guitar tracks on there, usually I don't really know what the vocal's doing. So it's a little bit of guesswork.
Interesting. Yeah.
And, and so, you know, it depends because, you know, like you might have like the entire band sitting on the couch behind you, as well as the engineer and the producer and the crew and everybody. Or it might just be me and the producer and the engineer, you know?
Sure.
And any, you know, version of that, you know? It's funny, man, being in a band, like our band has really, like, I was so freaked out by that when I was younger, you know, about having to kind of get up and work out a part while everybody's sitting, you know, while you got like the chorus of people behind you, like short order cooking you.
Sure.
No, don't do that. Yeah, do that. Right, don't do that. Do that. No, do this. Do that. Yeah, you know, like that whole thing. But I really dig it now. Like I kind of thrive on that. Like it's just how we always do it, you know? So it's like, you gotta just kind of jump into it and
just roll
and,
with it.
Get comfortable with it, you know? And there's always like, I'll bring in like an idea of what I want to do, but that always changes based on what Dave's thinking and what the producer's thinking and you know, what whoever else is on the couch is thinking. And it just always gets banged into something else.
And have you been writing songs with Dave so long now that do you feel like you kind of have an idea like what he would want to hear, or is it super open in your head when you're going into it?
Oh, it's really interesting. Like, you know, I've been in the band like 21 years now.
Yeah.
And we've made a bunch of records. And yeah, I think I do have a pretty good sense of, at least maybe not exactly what he's going to want me to be playing, but I know generally speaking what he doesn't want me to be playing, you know?
Right. Okay. So,
you know, I know certain things to maybe just not do.
What's something that'll never make the cut with? Like a whammy bar, something like that.
Oh yeah, whammy. Well, maybe. I mean, that almost could make the cut. I don't know. I mean, sometimes it's like, there's a couple tracks on this new record that I was like, wait, what? You want me to do what?
Oh really? Okay.
Yeah, you know what I mean. Like, because there aren't really a lot of like leads in Foo Fighters songs, and there's a couple on this new record that I was like, oh okay, you want me to go there? Let's fucking go there.
Right, right.
And so stuff like that. But you know, it's hard to put a finger exactly on what not to do, but it really depends on the song.
Right.
You know, I was going to like figuring that like a pretty high percentage of stuff isn't going to wind up in the mix, you know, like it's just the way that goes, you know,
right.
and the things that get in there, you know, are hopefully some good stuff.
That's cool. So you don't, you're not really like living and dying with every part. You're just like, you know, you're in there, you're creating the best thing for the song and then just see how it plays out kind of.
Well, it's a trip like with the way that we made this new record, because, you know, we made the record and then everything shut down for months. And then we got back together and we're rehearsing and stuff to get ready to do some performance stuff for around the record. And I had to go back and like kind of relearn the songs, you know, and you got to figure like, we didn't do a lot of pre-production. So there wasn't like, it wasn't like parts that I had like worked out over weeks or something. It was like parts that you just kind of figured out in the moment.
Right.
And I'd listen back to a song and be like, I don't remember what the fuck I did on it. I don't know. I don't even know if I'm on this, you know what I mean? Much less like if maybe I did that thing. That sounds kind of familiar. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's always that too. Like you get a mix back and there might be fucking 20 guitar tracks on it. You're like, I can't even tell what any of them are doing.
Yeah,
you
know, right.
Do some version of it, you know, that sounds right.
You guys need like one of those, like, what do you call them? Like an orchestrator to come in after the fact and kind of like chart it out. Okay, you're going to play this part. You're going to play this part.
You know, seriously, it wouldn't surprise me if at some point we get with there's like the Foo Fighter MD.
There's one thing I wanted to talk to you about while I had you here, because you're in a unique position to answer this question. You know, and I've asked this question to a lot of people who are not nearly as well-versed to answer it as you are. So you've basically, as you said, you've been in one of or the biggest hard rock band in the world in the last 20 years. So where do you see the future of hard rock? Like what things like should stay and are undeniable, and what things should we get rid of and changes we can expect?
Well, you know, it's always nice when like a Strokes moment happens. Like I love that, you know, because there always seems to be a back to basics kind of stripping away of the of the excess, you know, thing, and then that happens in various ways, and it's always different, you know. Like Nirvana were that at one point, you know. Like
sure.
I mean, people probably don't remember it this way, but Guns N' Roses was that.
Oh yeah,
you know. But in that whole Strokes, I mean, there's always kind of those moments, you know. The punk rock was that, you know, the original version of it. So I don't know. I mean, I don't want to talk shit about other bands and what they do. And I always figure like if people have success, good, you know, God bless them. It's a tough racket and not a lot of people, do, but I know what appeals to me and what doesn't. And I just don't, I'm not a huge fan of most like modern rock, modern heavy rock, mm-hmm. you know, it's just not a sound that appeals to me really ever. You know, I love like my old heavy metal records. I love classic rock. I love all that stuff. You know, I don't know if it's just because I'm, you know, getting old. Because you talk about this shit and you just sound like, you know, your grandpa or whatever. But I don't know, man. It's not for me. I like my rock and roll to sound like Ronnie James Dio fronting Rainbow. You know,
right?
That's what I dig.
Yeah.
It comes back to the songs, dude. It's, I think when genres get too old that people think that the songwriting falls away and it just becomes about the sound of the genre. You know, that's kind of what it seems like to me.
Modern heavy rock, when I do hear it, always just sounds real fuzzy. I don't know. It just sounds like oversaturated gain.
Oh,
guitars,
these kids, you know? These days, it's so fuzzy.
Give me
the guitars.
Give me that thin, brittle Marshall. I'll take it all day long. You know, that difficult, thin, brittle Marshall with not too much gain on it.
It is hard to like rock that, like, I mean, yeah, listen to all the early shit when they're playing through like fucking Vox amps and
totally.
Yeah, there was so much glass in that sound, and it was right. So like kind of, yeah, it was brittle, right? And but it rocked, dude.
I mean, I think that there's a lot of like, obviously there's great music that gets made in all kinds of different ways, and I shouldn't talk shit because of course we use Pro Tools and Logic, and our shit is totally manipulated digitally, all that stuff. I get it. But I think that is just a gigantic part of the problem for me personally with a lot of modern music. I just say music, not necessarily heavy rock, but I just think I like, that's what I love about records from a certain, you know, from the 50s to the 80s. Like that's like, it's not like people weren't cheating and fucking around and layering shit and manipulating things, of course, but it pretty much sounded like it would sound if you were in the room with Hank Williams to listen to one of his records. You know what I mean? Like, at least on a good night, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what I dig. That's the shit that I dig.
I mean, I get it. I mean, it's partially a baited question because, you know, I fucking hate most of it. I don't have as much as stake here as you. Like, I'll just go into it. Like, I think most of it fucking sucks. But as a guitar player,
I don't want to get beat up at a festival by all these bands. You know what I mean?
Oh, I know. And they're usually jacked. Like the people in these bands, they're usually like 21 and jacked. And I'm like, you know what, motherfucker, you were on the football team and you should have stayed there. Okay. Like,
I really shouldn't talk shit because like, you know, I've been making like writing a bunch of songs and recording lots of demos. And I always love like, I like when like, you know, like that era when the Clash were like putting crazy drum machines on things. And it's like that hybrid. And I do that on my own music, and I'll probably do that on some of my new solo stuff in a way that I haven't really done before. Like maybe have like some kind of like drum machine shit going on in there in a way, you know, with the analog thing. I love that when you overlap those two things. So I'm not like a Luddite exactly.
Yeah.
I'm not anti-technology. I don't know. I'm old and I've been around for probably too long, and it just takes certain things to get me excited. And most of what I hear doesn't.
Well, it's not about it being, you know, being inventive and, you know, treading new ground and stuff. You know, it's a huge part of music and rock and roll just in general.
Well, lucky for us, the genre seems to be completely dying.
Probably
won't even be an issue anymore.
Yeah, this conversation's moot in about 16 months anyway. Yeah. Well, good for us. Good for us. Rock is dying. Bunch of old rock dudes on podcasts. We'll all have a lot to do.
Let's end it on a bunch of grouchy guys bitching about the future.
Yeah, that's
a good place to cut out.
Get off my lawn, you little bastard!
Now, Brad, what do I do with this file? Do I leave it open? Sweetheart?
It's so fitting that this interview started with me watching a YouTube tutorial on how to use Flex Pitch. Now we're ending on this.
You completely freaked me out with that. I couldn't figure out what was going on.
But Chris, thanks so much for coming on last minute, giving us all this time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no worries.
So much
man.
Fun talking to you.
It was really fun, man. I enjoyed it. And I always love going on somebody else's podcast so I don't have to do any preparation.
Awesome. Well, thanks again.
Right on, guys.
All right. That was long overdue. Thanks, Chris.
Oh, my goodness. What a guy. What a fun guy. And what a cool life.
I last time I saw those guys, after the show, it was at MSG, Madison Square Garden, and I sent him this picture that I had taken from the side of the stage, which was it was two of his boys, mm-hmm. and then at least and one other kid, maybe Dave Grohl's son, or you know, at the side of the stage, like watching these guys, and it's a great shot. I sent it to Chris. I'm like, hey, I really enjoyed your Bring My Kids to Work Day experience. And it's, you know, I got the perfect angle. The kids are sitting down like on the side of the stage. There's Chris like in the lights, and then you can see all the audience of like Madison Square Garden out there. And it's like,
so cool.
Bring your kids to work day, dude. Meanwhile, you know, as he said, his kids are completely jaded on his music. Although maybe they're Foo Fighters fans, who knows? But
yeah, that's been a pretty hilarious theme that's come up concurrently in Going Off Track. Is all these like really great musicians and borderline like famous rock stars whose kids could give a fuck.
They got to, right? I mean, they got to. That's what your kids do. They don't.
So,
think you're
but
cool.
What's the trick then? Because like I always see, like, say, okay. Right. I saw Rob Trujillo, you know, who that, you know, or I don't know if I'm saying his name right, from Metallica, right. Who was in Suicidal Tendencies, that guy. Mm-hmm. Like his kid came up to play with Metallica fairly recently and he looked just like, him. You know, he just had the long hair, the stash. He played bass. He played bass well enough to be in Metallica. So I wonder what did he do? To get his kids into it when people like you and Chris are telling me, yeah, like my kids fucking hate what I do. They can give a shit.
Well, after the fact, your kids grow into it, you know, like it's like, I think the thing that I love about it is I think it's, you know, for all the non rock stars out there whose kids think they're not cool. Just remember, Chris Shiflett's kids don't think that he's cool.
Right. Yeah.
You know, just take it to heart. You know, it's a good message.
Yeah, there's like just no dad in the world who's just not like the biggest like goof nerd to their kids. It's weird. But maybe we're just not being military enough on him, right? Because I just heard a story about a guy named DK Metcalf. He's a football player. We won't get into it. But basically, the guy is like the most jacked athlete you've ever seen. Like no human should look like this. And there was a story that his father was claiming that he could bench press 50 pounds and squat 100 pounds at 5 years old. And then I'm like looking at my son who's five and I'm like, what the fuck you doing? Like you haven't benched once, you know, like I'm like, it's possible, but I don't know if these people are like making their kids do it and drilling it into it, or if they actually showed a real interest. You know, I feel like I'm going to be such a hippie about everything. It would be like, yeah, bro, like do what you want.
He's
probably not going to do anything but play fucking video games. Like, should I be harder?
I just don't know that kids until a certain age, I feel like, yeah, I think the parents are drilling it into them. I think it takes to a certain age before you can get interested in, although I got to say, my 9-year-old is really, for some reason, taken to seeing how many sit-ups he can do. And he claimed, I've sat and watched him do 200 like that.
What?
And he claimed the other morning, he gets up, you know, he gets up before everybody else in the house. And he came in and woke me up at like 7:30. He's like, Dad, I just did 450 sit-ups.
Get the fuck out of here. What's going on there?
I don't know. It's probably one of his buddies, you know, had a contest with him and he thinks it's cool to do sit-ups. So that's his thing. I'm like, do some freaking, you know, push-ups too, if you really want to get this going.
You're like, bro, please just do some arpeggios.
Yeah, exactly. Like
something. Skip the sit-ups, man. Can you do some scales?
He's doing good. He's into guitar. He's been playing. He's really into Ozzy. The first thing I think he ever learned was Crazy Train.
That's pretty tough.
Yeah.
All right. So I guess you're doing it. If your son's playing Crazy Train on guitar and doing 450 sit-ups in the morning. It sounds like you got a pretty cool fucking ripper over there, Brad. I think you're doing a good job.
Of course, it took a cousin to really get him into the guitar, though. But yeah, he had a head start from me. And
dude, I just imagine one of his little nine-year-old friends doing the like Rocky thing right now. You know, where like he sits up and then he smacks his stomach twice, you know, to get it nice and hard for the boxing match. What if your son wound up like, in the spirit of what Chris was talking about with boxing and Manny Pacquiao, what if your son wound up being like a featherweight boxer?
I don't know. I have mixed feelings about boxing, but
yeah,
I could deal. Featherweight's not bad.
Would you wear a pimp suit to the match?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. You have unlimited budget. And Oscar is fighting his first title fight at Bally's Caesar's down in Atlantic City. What do you wear?
Benny, I'll tell you right now that before I got married and had kids,
yeah,
I took a trip to Las Vegas with a good friend of mine. And before we went, out of our way to find the nastiest polyester cowboy suits, but like suits, you know, like a jacket, you know, with like those lapels,
sure,
and cowboy hats. And we did and nasty like Elvis sunglasses. And we spent a weekend in Vegas and we didn't leave our hotel without wearing those suits.
Wow.
So I'm ready, dude. I will pimp out for Vegas anytime.
All right. I still have two questions then. So, all right, that weekend, tell me, like, were people treating you differently?
The only part that was kind of embarrassing was we were at Caesar's at like 2 a.m. and this drunk, this drunk American indigenous person came up to me and was like, was so psyched. He's like, it's so good to see two real cowboys in Las Vegas.
What did you do as you play it
off? I was so embarrassed, dude. And I was so looped that I just played it off as best I could. And
yeah.
He was really wasted, that dude.
So. Brad the ranch hand. All right, so we found out so you still didn't tell me. I want like a basic description.
I might revive that suit. I might revive it. It was good. It was very uncomfortable. It was full thick polyester. Like
yeah.
You couldn't wrinkle it no matter what you tried. And I might go for that again.
You know, it's so tricky when you're like an alternative guy and you have to wear a suit. You know, I never know how to play it, right? Because if you just wear a suit, you look like the guy who wears a suit once a year and puts it back in the closet and then wears a suit again. Like, it's pretty obvious you're a guy who doesn't wear a suit every day.
Right.
And then the other option is kind of that, like, I'm a rock and roll guy wearing a suit look, you know, which always has like the same elements to it. It's like, oh, Foreigner won a Grammy. It's like what they would wear when they went up. You know, there's some element of leather or something like that.
Oh, no.
You know what I mean?
You
like,
just need to get
like,
a
it's
tasteful...
almost like for someone like me, I can't find a non-embarrassing way to wear a suit. So I have even considered, like, I'm not saying I'll ever win a Grammy, but if I do, or if I go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or something where, like, I'm going to have to be an old man displaying myself in a rock and roll scenario and I have to look nice, I've considered, like, how would I play it? Am I playing it straight? Am I going to be like old rock and roll dude look, you know, with the, you know, a little bit of chest hair popping out, maybe a cool necklace and some rings or something? Or do I just go full on, like, I don't take any of this seriously and wear like a Dumb and Dumber tuxedo? You know, like with the orange hat.
Right.
Or do I go flat pimp? You know, like, but then am I appropriating another culture? I don't know, man. I don't know what to do with my suit game.
I always think that you can't go wrong with just the classic sort of like Rat Pack, thin tie, like fairly trim cut, you know. I mean, American suits are cut like shit. You know, you got to go with like a more European cut. It's kind of trim.
Yes.
And you can't go wrong with that look, dude, no matter whether you're a rocker or a fucking mod or whatever.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I tend to lean towards European soccer coach. You know, like the slim cut shirt. I'll just say it right here. Those guys are great looking, you know?
Yeah.
They're great looking men, and they just look great.
They age well.
That's what I try to do. Yeah, they age well. So, yeah, I'm like trying to be like a mid-40s, like Italian soccer coach who's in like the Bundesliga. Like, yeah, that's like my look, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Pretty interesting stuff, huh? Hey, Chris Shiflett fans, did you enjoy that?
There's nobody still here. We got to wrap this up. So listen, okay. I thank Max again. I want to thank Justin J. He's got a podcast called The Plug. We plugged it in the middle of the show. You should check it out. Chris is on that show. And he's got some other guests that are pretty interesting. He's kind of just getting it going, but there's a bunch of interesting episodes up there. You can find Chris on Instagram at Shifty71. That's S-H-I-F-T-Y 71. He's at Twitter at Chris Shiflett 71. And you probably can't guess the year he was born. But and you can find us, of course, Going Off Track at all the socials, goingofftrack.com. Mm-hmm. Leave us a nice review on iTunes. Mm-hmm. You can leave us a nice tip at Venmo at Off Track.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you're really serious and you really want to be, you want to join the team, as I like to say, patreon.com/goingofftrack. There's bonus material up there. There's actually, if you're an Uber fan and you're still here, there is going to be some bonus material from this interview, because after we stopped recording formally, I still had my ghetto recorder going and we had a little conversation about stuff that, that could have been part of the show, but it won't be. It's for patrons.
I didn't say anything embarrassing in that part, did I?
No. But I'm going to say that you did, so that people want to go listen.
Yeah, it'll only be our Patreons who can hear it. So, so you let me know how bad I embarrassed myself. Well, thank you, anyone who has been here for the last 2 hours. Today also marked the 40-year anniversary of John Lennon's passing.
Ooh.
So I want everyone to imagine peace and love and understanding. Try to be cooler to each other. Take care of each other. Team human, you know?
I hear you, dude. We could use some.
So I love you, Brad, and I love everyone out there. Well, not everyone. If you're a piece of shit, I might not love you. I've cursed a lot. Let's go.
All right.
Done.
Good night.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.